going to be. Tov. Okay, so let's get back to work. We are holding in page 4. And we finished the first point that the Rav makes, which is sort of defining, when he defines that the loneliness that he's going to address, that he thinks that he's suffering, that the Rav says he's suffering, is not loneliness of being alone, of Eicha Yoshev Vaadod. It's not loneliness of Kierkegaardian anguish or existential loneliness from Sartre, etc. We spoke Barichas about. But rather, there's a special loneliness that only the man of faith suffers. And let's stop from the very bottom of page 3, the last line. He says, on the other hand, I also feel invigorated. You want to look on? I also feel invigorated. Notice he says the loneliness that only the man of faith suffers. He says, I also feel invigorated because this very... We did go a little further, but I'm going back because there was a point that I said we get back to. We skipped it, which I think is important. Everything okay?
Yeah, I'm going to get that. What is copy?
Oh, wow. That's where you are.
Where are you? What paragraph does it start
with? I'm at the very top of page 4. Oh, the paragraph...
Five,
oh,
it's page chapter 5. 1.
I'm holding
one A. Right,
we're after he quotes from the psalmist, from the "My father and mother forsaken me, I despair because I'm lonely, hence feel frustrated."
The
very first page.
32:10. In the parentheses of Deuteronomy 32:10.
Does it?
And my death will in hell.
Yes. Right. Okay. You have it? No.
What's the first line of the paragraph that it's called?
I also. It is.
It's the very first paragraph in the book.
The nature.
By where it says, I also feel invigorated, Shalom. No? Can I see for a second? Let me see. Let me see.
Mine starts differently. I have the fake version.
This is the introduction. Here it is. On the other hand. On the other hand, I also feel invigorated because this very experience of loneliness presses everything in me into the service of God. And as the Rav is going to be, this book is not a depressing book. The Rav wants to morph this loneliness that he's saying is the essential state of the person of faith. He wants to, we're going to understand where it comes from and also understand how it could be something that's a positive force. So he feels invigorated because this very experience of loneliness presses everything in me into the service of God. Meaning it becomes one-on-one. Remember we spoke about last time, I mentioned to you the secret of Shemoneh Esrei, of one-on-one before God. That even though there's a whole minyan, but it's one-on-one. In my desolate howling solitude, I experience a growing awareness that, to paraphrase Plotinus's apothegm about prayer, which we're going to get back to in a second, this growing awareness that, to paraphrase Plotinus, apatha means a saying, an adage about prayer, this service to which I, a lonely and solitary individual, am committed, is wanted and gracefully accepted by God in his transcendental loneliness and numinous solitude. Now, last time we continued the next paragraph because I wanted to get through the three stages of loneliness, but we didn't really explain what does this sentence mean. It's a very deep sentence. And he's going to elaborate it more in the book, but I don't like going through things quickly just for the sake of going through them. The Rav says that it means that we have to understand what the sentence is saying, and it's a very important idea that he's saying here. What is this invigoration that he's feeling from the loneliness? It's pressing him into the service of God. And through the desolate howling solitude, I experience an awareness that this service to which I, a lonely and solitary individual, is committed, in other words, because I feel lonely, that makes me feel that because I'm this lonely individual and I'm serving God, the loneliness itself is what's causing that God, in his transcendental loneliness, should accept my prayer. We getting that? Mm-hmm. It's because I'm lonely that God accepts my prayer. Why? Because God is also lonely. Into God's transcendental loneliness and numinous solitude. Do you know what the word numinous means? Numinous is actually a word that was made up from one of the Rav's favorite theologians, Rudolf Otto. Rudolf Otto, the famous book, The Idea of the Holy, Rudolf Otto, who's one of the first, in the early 20th century, one of the first philosophers that actually dealt with the phenomenology of religion. He took up after William James. William James was the first one, Varieties of Religious Experience. Then Rudolf Otto continued it. And Rudolf Otto has the famous idea of the mysterium tremendum, which the Rav quotes all the time, the tremendous mystery, the otherness of God, the holy other with a W, the holy otherness of God. And one of the words that Rudolf Otto coined is the feeling that religious person has of the feeling of noumena. Something numinous means something that's mysterious, that it's like some kind of like mystical feeling, which we've all had in davening. The feeling in davening where you taka feel once in a while doesn't happen often, especially, you know, during the week when you're late for a meeting or something. But once in a while, you know, you have that feeling when you're down Shemoneh Esrei and you feel that mezanin abyssal hecher. I feel a little higher taka, mezakten yiddish, a tefach hecher from the earth, a tefach higher than the earth. Once in a while, I daven Shemoneh Esrei and I feel that there's something deeper going on. That's the feeling of a numinous feeling, the feeling of a noumena that Rudolf Otto spoke about, that you, so to speak, raising yourself up to that holy other, and holy with an H and with a W. And that's the numinous solitude of God, that mysterious, transcendent, you know, oblique loneliness of God. And so the Rav is saying that when I feel that loneliness, and again, he's going to elaborate upon this a lot in the book, he's just saying it in the beginning as the introduction, so to speak, this loneliness can and needs to be transformed into the deepest connection to God. It's going to make that I could come to that the opposite. This loneliness is a prerequisite to be able to really connect to God at the deepest level. Could you pour me some? That's the diet one? Yeah. Pour me some. That you're able to connect to God in the deepest way because He's lonely God, whatever that means, which we're going to speak about, that makes that I have that relationship with Him. Now, what I want to spend some time talking about now, a couple of minutes, thank you. To paraphrase Plotinus's apothegm about prayer. What is the Rav talking about over here? Now, I got to tell you, I asked Rabbeinu Google. I asked Rabbeinu Google a few times. And every time I looked about Plotinus quotes about prayer, nothing. I looked up a lot of different quotes. He's not known for specific quotes per se. And when I put in these exact words, so Lonely Man of Faith came up. Lonely Man of Faith came up. So, you know, Plotinus quotes about prayer, apothegm about prayer. So first of all, but I did some research, but first I want to tell you the reason that I'm harping on this is two reasons. First of all, because it's always geschmack to learn some pagan philosophy. You know what I'm saying? It's like, how often do you get the opportunity that you could learn pagan philosophy and not have guilt about it because the Rav is quoting? Second of all, really three reasons. Second of all, because Plotinus is beautiful. Plotinus is, I don't know if any of you have ever read Plotinus inside, he's beautiful. But third of all, because Plotinus is an extremely important figure in history. I don't know if I don't know if you've heard of Plotinus, and some of you I know listen to the Halachic Man classes, so I definitely spoke about it then, but Plotinus is probably, ends up being one of the most important forces in Western civilization without most people even knowing it.
What century is it?
So I just want to say he's one of the most important figures in Western civilization without most people knowing about it because of one of his greatest disciples that really forged the psyche of Western civilization. Now, first of all, Plotinus was a disciple of Plato, which means he was approximately the 4th century BCE. Has anyone ever heard of the word Neoplatonism? Neoplatonic? I know today everyone's speaking Neo-Hasidic, right? But Neoplatonic. Anyone ever heard of Neoplatonism? No? Okay, so Plotinus is the one that brought about Neoplatonism. The reason that he's so important is because there was a figure in the 4th century CE who was really the founder of Christian theology. I know we always say that, everyone knows that Jesus didn't found Christianity, we always say that Paul did. That itself is a matter of debate. But one thing for sure, Paul, you could say, founded the idea of the religion of Christianity, but not the theology of Christianity. The theology of Christianity is like Rabbi Yaakov said, it was Augustine. I always used to pronounce it Augustine also, but I have a friend that's Catholic, a priest, and he said to me that's always the telltale sign if you're a Catholic or Protestant, is that the Protestants pronounce it Augustine and the Catholics pronounce it Augustine.
So that makes sense, because I'm Protestant.
Oh, you're right. He's a Huguenot, right. He's from France. He's a Huguenot, right.
Also, I think almost everyone would say Plotinus.
Would say, really?
I think so.
Could be. I always have that problem because I didn't hear these things in class. So I just, it's from reading it. So.
Same guy.
You get the point. Anyway, so Augustine, Saint Augustine, or Augustine, however you want to refer to him. So, again, I spoke about this a lot in the Halachic Man class, and I don't want to spend a lot of time now, but it is important to point out. The whole concept of Western civilization, of there being a split of church and state, of this whole idea of the supernal heavenly realm and the terrestrial earthly realm, comes from Augustine's book, City of God. City of God is one of the most fundamental books written in the history of Western civilization. It's actually interesting, after I spoke about this in Halachic Man, in the earlier class in Halachic Man, a few months later, a philosopher called Arthur Hyman put out a book called The Cave and the Light about how the two shitas of Aristotle and Plato go through the entire history of the Western civilization, of the schism between faith and reason and science and religion, etc., and all these things. But Augustine was the first one that...
Arthur Hyman as in the dean, former dean of Revel?
I don't know, and I don't... Could you move? Yeah. I don't know. I'm not sure if it's the same one. The idea of the City of God, the idea of that book, is that the concept of always having to negate this reality, negate this world, being religious, the thrust of religion is to negate this world, leave this world is meaningless, really the heavenly city, the heavenly Jerusalem, that's all based on City of God. Augustine wrote City of God when Rome was being destroyed, when Rome was being sacked by barbarians, and Rome at that time was already a Christian city, so it was almost like the complete downfall of Christianity at the time, the Khorban of Christianity, and therefore he came up with this whole theology, this whole idea of that the real reality is the supernal transcendent reality. And that began, again, in all of civilization, the whole idea of there being this separation, again, in Christianity for sure it's the negation of physicality, celibacy, the asceticism, but all strains in the history of religions, Western civilization, not Eastern, but in Western civilization, all strains in the history of religion, which is about going out of this world in physicality, is directly come from that book, City of God, of Augustine, and that's why it was the beginning of the theology of Christianity. Augustine was a disciple of Plotinus, or Plotinus, however, but I'm going to say Plotinus. He was a disciple of his, and everything that he wrote is based on his writings. Now, Plotinus was a mystic. Plotinus's philosophy was Neoplatonism. And to understand just a little basically, because I want to learn with you a little from Plotinus. So, what's the idea of Neoplatonism? And to understand how that brought about Augustine's theology. So, first of all, what was the main philosophy of Plato, as brought in many of his dialogues, especially in the Republic, but the main idea of Plato, which I'm sure you're all familiar, is the theory of ideas. Mm-hmm. But just to say it very quickly, what's the idea of Plato, which really, again, based on Socrates? Socrates would annoy people, as the gadfly of Athens, he would go around and he would annoy people by saying to people to define terms, to try to define things that everyone understood as being self-understood. People, you know, take things for granted. You could do this with frum people, it's a lot of fun. You know, ask a frum person, like, you know, what does it mean to connect to God? See how quickly or how many words they'll be able to put in an answer in a sentence. What does it mean to connect to God? It's always fun to do that. So that's what Socrates did for a living, and he got killed for it. But basically, the point that he tried to, in Plato's writings, the point that he was trying to say is that he wanted to make people, everyone knows the famous parable of the cave. Everyone is in the cave, the famous parable of Plato, that he wanted to show that this world is only a faint revelation and an emanation from a higher realm. He gave the parable of people that lived their life in a cave, and they saw on the wall shadows. And somebody came into the cave and said, "What you're looking at is just shadows. Come outside of the cave and you'll see the real source of everything." And Socrates says that that's the job of the philosopher. And how did the philosopher go about doing that? For instance, let's just take one example. If I would say to you, let's take the easy example, a chair. So what's a chair? So we're all sitting on a chair, right? So this is a chair. Now, have you ever seen, on one of my favorite plays, Metropolitan Museum of Art, you go, they have the 19th century furniture. You ever go in the Metropolitan Museum of Art where they have like literally... rebuilt, restructured rooms from 19th century France, and you see the type of furniture they sat or they lived in. So let's say a chair like that. That's a chair that's worth a couple of $1 million. Right? The chairs that King Louis XVI sat on or something, right? So if this is a chair that we're sitting on, and that's a chair, so which is the real chair? Well, that's also a chair. Or let me ask you another question. If I take a piece of wood and I put it on a fire hydrant, is that a chair? What would you say? How would you define a chair? Something you sit on. So if I put a piece of wood on a fire hydrant, does that become a chair? Most people will say no. So then what is a chair? What constitutes a chair? Four legs? What if it has two? But it looks like a chair, but only has two legs. So eventually Socrates would get people to show that they can't define what a chair is. And yet everyone has automatically within you, you know that these are all chairs. So then what's the ultimate chair? What constitutes chairness? So what Socrates eventually said is that there's the ultimate chair, which is the form, the idea of the chair in a supernal realm, and all the physical chairs are different revelations, manifestations of that supernal chair. But of course, a chair is something stupid. But let me take a different example. Socrates took a better example. We all want to be good. What is goodness? What does it mean to be good? Define good. Helping old lady cross the street. Okay, that's good. What else is good?
Vanilla ice cream.
Vanilla ice cream is good.
Very.
What else is good? What else is good? How would you define good? Is you say to your child, be a good boy. That's pretty ethereal. What does that mean to be good? And yet we'll all have different things and we'll go through and say what's good, what's not good. Eventually we'll come to realize that there's an essential goodness and all these specifics. In other words, Plato was looking for the universal. The universal from which the particulars derive. And you come to understand that anything in this world, the particulars of this world are deriving from a higher source called the idea of good. And the philosopher's job is to come and realize those ideas as they are in their pristine state. Now, anyone that's at all familiar with Kabbalah knows that this is all in Kabbalah. It's the idea of the 10 spheres, the idea of emanations of one world from another. If anyone ever learned Shaar Yichud V'Emunah, the second part of Tanya, so you know the Baal Shem Tov's teaching based, of course, on the Zohar and the Arizal, of the fact that all physical things in this world come from the oisius of the Dvar Havaya, the letters of the divine speech. In Malchus D'Atzilus, in the world of Atzilus, there are letters of divine speech, which every chair comes from the letters Kuf Samach Aleph, are all derivatives of the divine speech. Tov is Chesed D'Atzilus, God's Chesed, which emanates to this world. Plato, of course, now here is one of those, the point of contention. We believe, at least many believe, that Plato got his ideas from the Jews. There are those that say that Plato got his ideas from the Jews, from the Nevi'im, etc. Be that as it may, but of course there are a lot of ideas in Kabbalah that are very similar to this, the idea of the emanations of worlds. Now, Plato pretty much left it as a philosophy. The generation after Plato, Plotinus, and the philosophers, Porphyry and other philosophers of this time, then took this and made it into an entire pagan religion. Because what eventually comes from this whole thing is that once you understand that this world is only a ray and only a faint glimmer and you're in a cave and everything that you see is just the shadows on the cave, if you're enough of a real person and you meditate that enough, you want to go out of the cave. And then became the whole Neoplatonic philosophy, which was shunning this world, to be able to go out of this cave, as we're about to see, and to go to those higher supernal worlds. Kabbalah is the same thing. That's why most of the Kabbalists were ascetics. The Baal Shem Tov turned that on its face, right? The Baal Shem Tov came and said that God's essence is in this world. We're not going to get into Chassidus now, but the Kabbalists, Kabbalah and Neoplatonism is very similar. And you'll find a lot of places, a lot of academics will compare Neoplatonic and the early Kabbalists, and they'll, of course, the academics will say that the Kabbalah got it from the Neoplatonists, and we'll say they got it from the Kabbalists, but it's obviously very similar. Yeah.
You started to say, where does Kabbalah and you started to say Kabbalah and Plato disagree at some point.
Why? No, I said that the Baal Shem Tov disagrees. The Baal Shem Tov turned it upside down by coming to say that Dafke in the physical is where you find God's essence. Mm-hmm. And that's what Halachic Mani speaks a lot about. I don't want to get into it now, but there he speaks about a Barichas. Okay, but no, it's very hard to see exactly what's the difference between Kabbalah and Neoplatonism, other than the fact that Neoplatonism is Avodah Zarah, as we're about to see. But other than that, slight, you know, difference, but you'll see what I mean in a second. Okay, but let's take a look inside. I want to learn inside with you. So this is what I think the Rav is referring to. And again, I just want to, since the Rav is mentioning it, I want to see it as what I think is the Rav's source, and also to have a taste of this beautiful philosophy. 154. We're starting where it says page 154. It's really beautiful. You'll be able to see why this became so meaningful in Western civilization. It's a whole new way of looking at the world. Look. So he says like that. Now it's going to sound to you, anyone that's familiar with Chassidus Sfarim and Kabbalah, it's going to sound very familiar. So I'm just telling you before, and of course the academics will say that Kabbalah got it from here. We believe the opposite.
When's the spring?
What? Before Churban Bayis Sheni. Definitely before Chab, during the time of Churban, during the time of Bayis Sheni. Which they're definitely war Mekubalim. I mean, they're war Mekubalim at the time. Right? They definitely were, but they're not, that's the whole problem with Kabbalah, that it doesn't seem to be documented very much in Judaism. Right? Which is what led some people to say that it comes from later on. That whole controversy, which we won't get into.
Why is it threatening to say that the Kabbalists learn philosophy? Is it? I mean, don't one of the Lubavitcher Rebbeim basically spit out verbatim the analogy of the cave? I forget.
The Mitzvah Rebbe brings it. Yeah.
So the Miller is it?
It's not threatening to say that anyone learned philosophy. It's apikursis to say that Kabbalah is based on philosophy.
If they saw an idea in the secular world that they thought had a lot of merit, why is that a problem?
Good question. Could anyone answer that? Chachma b'goyim tamen, right?
Okay.
But one answer is, what are the words right before Chachma b'goyim tamen? Torah b'goyim al tamen. Chachma we could learn from goyim, 100%. Torah we can't. Now, what that means, especially for the Rav, what it means you can't learn Torah from goyim and Chachma you can't. What's the difference between Torah and Chachma? We're not going to get into now. But one thing for sure, what makes Kabbalah, Soid, different than the rest of Paradise? What's the most important distinction between Kabbalah and the rest of the parts of Torah? I'll give you a hint. It's in the name. Could you say a Chiddush in Kabbalah? What was that? It's like a Shmak, a Pilpul, and a Shtikl, and an Eitz Chaim. Chas v'sholom. As opposed to all other parts of Torah where it's a mitzvah Yagdil Torah v'yadir, it's a mitzvah to say Chiddushim. Kabbalah, you can't say Chiddushim. Kabbalah means the Kabel. You have to receive it. You have to receive it because it's about God. You can't like make up theology. So therefore, Kabbalah can't be that it's taken from Goyim, as believing people, because these are saying things about what Gershon Sholem first was the Godhead, about God, about the way God manifests. So that has to be coming from a place of complete Torah and Kedusha. Let's see inside. What can it be that has brought the souls to forget the Father God? And through though members of the divine, even though the souls are members of the divine, and entirely of that world, to ignore at once themselves and it. Isn't that beautiful? This is mamish gorgeous. It's one of the reasons I'm doing it. It's so beautiful. What can it be that brought the soul to forget God the Father? And even though the souls are members of the divine, and entirely of that world, to ignore at once themselves and it. As we forget from Vana Mekunt, we forget from where we come. We forget that Neshamas come from Hashem. Right? How could it be? You know the Shpol HaZeda is Nigen? Kol Beyar? You know the Shpol HaZeda was, right? Shpol HaZeda was the generation of Nachman Breslover. He was a Talmud of the Magid. And he actually was very against Rav Nachman and Breslov, but the Shpol HaZeda was very, very much Bislavus. He always was very on fire. So, and it says that one time the Baal Shem Tov, when he was a little boy, he put his hand on the Shpol HaZeda's heart. The Shpol HaZeda said, from the moment when he was a little boy that the Baal Shem Tov put his hand on my heart, I always feel hot over here. It's always hot from the Baal Shem Tov's touch. And he was very much on fire all the time. And there's a niggun, which I can't really sing for you because I don't have a good voice. It's a whole niggun called Kol Bayar Anoichi Shemeya Futter and Wald Zuch Seine Kinder. I hear a voice in the forest. A father in the forest is looking for his children. Kinder, Kinder, wo sein die gewesen? Children, children, where are you? You forgot about me. That's the whole all the mishalim, all the parables in Judaism are about that we forget our father. That even though our souls come from, that we forget about it. So look. It says, the evil that has overtaken them has its source in self-will. Now, evil here, he doesn't mean, you know, like Hitler and Gargamel and stuff. He doesn't mean like, you know, bad guys, Darth Vader. Well, Darth Vader ended up doing tshuva, but he doesn't mean evil. What he means evil meaning forgetting about God. That's what he means is evil. The evil that has overtaken them has its source in self-will. What does it mean, self-will? Into the entry into birth, in the desire for self-ownership. Now, what does that mean? I want to be my own thing. I want self-gratification. It's even before Koichi Baitzim Yodi. Koichi Baitzim Yodi is already stage two. Stage one is that I just want to, you know, I want to have self-ownership. I want to enjoy myself. I want to have my own desires. I want to enjoy myself.
So it's a conscious decision, you're saying. It's not like
entry into birth.
Okay.
They conceived a pleasure in this freedom and largely indulged their own motion. Thus they were hurried down the wrong path and drifting further and further, came to lose even the thought of their origin in the divine. That's Koichi Baitzim Yodi. You see? You see how he's saying it's like two stages? First is the feeling I want to have a geshmak, a self-gratification. And then they hurried down the wrong path, drifting further and further, came to lose even the thought of their origin in the divine. Atei geshmak of art from the Rebbe Rayat. So we just said that there are two stages. Stage one is going after taivas, that a person wants to fulfill their own desires, that becomes the most important thing in my life. I want to have a good time. I want to forget. I want to enjoy myself or whatever. That causes one to eventually completely forget about God. But the Rebbe Rayat, the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, said that there's a stage even before those two. And he says that's what we say in Yom Kippur by Vidui. We say Al Chet Shechatanu Lefanecha B'Yetzahara. Remember in the Vidui, one of the Al Chets is Al Chet Shechatanu Lefanecha B'Yetzahara. So the previous Rebbe said, isn't every chet with the Yetzahara? What does it mean, Al Chet Shechatanu Lefanecha B'Yetzahara? Right? The sin that I did with the Yetzahara, what's the sin? So the Vidui Rebbe said like this, that there's a chazal that say that the Yetzahara Hayoim Oimelay Asekach, Ulamachalay Oimelay Asekach, and in the end he does a Vedazara. So Yetzahara first says do this, then he says do that, and in the end he does a Vedazara. Now, but Pashup Shah, when you learn that chazal, what a chazal, what does it mean the Yetzahara says to do this day, next day, that day, that there's a procession. First the Yetzahara says, you know, Chveis,
A light sin,
a parva avera. You know, something not a big deal. So do a parva avera. Then he says, do a fleisha got there. And then the next is a veda zara. But the Friedrich Rebbe read like this. The previous Rebbe said, when the Yetzirah, the first thing says, when the Yetzirah says, ase kach, hayayim amal Yetzirah ase kach, is the Yetzirah tells you to do a mitzvah. That's where he first gets you to listen to him. Hayayim amal ase kach, the Yetzirah says to you, do the mitzvah. Meaning what? What does it mean you do the mitzvah the Yetzirah says? The Yetzirah says, this mitzvah is a good idea, Taka. This week's parashat Mishpatim. Right? So the Yetzirah, this one, Taka, this is okay. Do this because it'll make you feel good. This one makes sense. This one will be good. This will be good for you. Go daven because, you know, this way people will look at you like you're frum. This way, you know, your wife will have nachas from you. You know, you do it because the Yetzirah says to do it. Right? And that's the Vav. That's the first letter in this week's Parsha. What does Rashi say about the Vav in this week's Parsha? Ve'eila mishpatim. What does Rashi say? Meisav al yishenam afeilu misinai, afeilu misinai. This is the Viz, and you have to remember that why does a Jew not steal? Well, some Jews do, but why is a Jew not supposed to steal? Why is a Jew keep a Bava Kam, Bava Metzi, and all the mishpatim? Why? Misinai. Because God said so. Not because it feels good, etc. So that's the Yetzirah's progression. But anyway, getting back. So, and then eventually, once you're in his grasp, then he gets you to do it. But here, Plotinus is saying, so you go down the wrong path, you drift further and further, came to lose even the third. Okay, I'm going to stop darshaning. Let's read inside. Children wrenched young from home. Listen how beautiful. Children wrenched young from home and brought up at a distance will fail in knowledge of their parents and themselves. In the same way, the souls no longer discern either the divinity or their own nature. Ignorance of their rank brings self-deprecation, self-depreciation. They no longer appreciate who they are. All their awe and admiration is for the alien. In other words, they start admiring not God, not the divine. And clinging to this, they have broken away as far as a soul may. Their regard for the mundane and their disregard of themselves bring about their utter ignoring of the divine. Sounds like a Musa Sefer, no? Mm-hmm. Sounds like a Musa Sefer. You get into Gashmias, forget about the Eivishter. Yeah, let's skip the brackets, go to the next side of the page. So how are you going to fix that? So now what Planus is going to talk about is how do you fix that? Which eventually is going to be what's called prayer. And that's how do you pray? Which is the opposite direction. Prayer is going as fixing that. A double discipline must be applied if human beings in this past are to be reclaimed and brought back to their origins. A double discipline. In order to go back to the origins, lifted once more towards the supreme and one and first. What's the double discipline? One method declares the dishonor of the objects which the soul holds here in honor, meaning gashmius, meaning physicality. The other recalls to the soul its race and dignity. No? What does that remind you of? Shulchan Aruch, what is Shulchan Aruch Siman Tzadik Vav about? It's actually Tzadik Ches, I think. Shulchan Aruch, I think Tzadik Vav. What's Shulchan Aruch Tzadik Ches about? The Allah in Shulchan Aruch that, you know, the Rebbe spoke about many times that from Jews, and it's a halacha that so many people don't do. It's a mamash halacha in Shulchan Aruch. It's a Ramah. And Shulchan Aruch says, no?
Say you're nothing for them.
What are the two things the Ramah says?
Hashem is great and I'm small.
Oh, it's a Ramah. Yizboinin begadlus hakel v'shiflus ha'adam. It's actually interesting. In 1952, they had one of the first, you know, meetings of the RCA, one of these rabbinical council, Gudas Rabbanim of, I don't know, one of these original, the old school meetings of rabbis, and they invited Lubavitch Rebbe. They wanted him to come, and he never went to any of these meetings, but he wrote a very interesting letter. And what did he write in the letter? It's very interesting. This bothered him. He wrote in the letter that he's asking that they should start speaking about in their shuls, that it's Alochem Shulchan Aruch, that before you daven, you have to do Isboinanus, you have to contemplate Gdula Sekel and Shifla Sa'aba. Most people don't even know there's such a halacha. Three times a day, before davening, a person, before opening one's mouth, one has to stop and think. Before opening the mouth, one has to think, one has to meditate. And gedulas hakel v'shiflas ha'adam. And that's what Plotinus is saying over here. The first, it's a double discipline. The dishonor of the objects which the soul holds here in honor, that's shiflas ha'adam, shiflas of gashmias. The other recalls to the soul's race and dignity. Now, look how beautiful. Let every soul, then, at the outset, recall. Now here we're gonna. Now we have to read. Look how he's gonna say, because it's beautiful, but you have to follow his train of thinking. Let every soul then, at the outset, recall that soul. Now here's soul with a capital letter. So he's referring to the world soul, meaning God. You know, where could you all tell me? Where do you know that you say every day at least once that God is the soul of the world? It's not a Kabbalistic prayer. The word nefesh is right near there. Baruch chei ha'ilamim. We say it every time we make a bar nefeshes. Baruch chei ha'ilamim. Or we say it in Baruch Shem Anishtabach. Yochid chei ha'ilamim. What does chei ha'ilamim mean? The soul of the world. The world's soul. That's what Chei Olamim means. Every time you drink a cup of water, you recognize God as being the soul of the world. Soul with a capital S. So look. Let every soul then at the outset recall that soul is the author of all living things. That it has breathed the life into them all. Whatever is nourished by earth and sea. All the creatures of the air. The divine stars in heaven. This divine soul, you meditate how God is the soul of all of reality. Now, anyone that's familiar with Chassidus knows that this is an idea in all of Chassidus, to meditate on God as being the soul of the world. It is the maker of the sun, this soul with a capital S, itself formed and ordered this vast heaven and conducts all its rhythmic motion. It must of necessity be more honorable than they, for they are born or dissolve, as soul brings them life or abandons them, but soul is of eternal being. And as you meditate, that the soul, that God is the soul of the world, is greater. First you meditate how he's the soul of everything. Then you meditate, but he's greater than everything else, because everything else would dissolve if you would go out of it. Remind anyone of something? Sharachet v'muna, right? Mm-hmm. Tanya, it's mamash the idea that you meditate how the world is being brought into existence by the light of God that permeates reality.
It sounds like monotheism, not like paganism.
That's just what I was going to say.
Good. It does sound like monotheism, right? Good. Very good. Okay. Hold that thought. So let the soul, because you say it's one soul that's filling everything, the trees and everything. Good. So let the soul that is not unworthy of the vision, meaning hopefully us, that we're not unworthy of the vision, contemplate the great soul, capital GS, freed from deceit and every witchery and collected into calm. Look how beautiful. Calmed be the body for it in that hour, and the tumult of the flesh, I, all that is about it, calm. One comes to calm and stillness when you meditate this meditation. Calm be the earth, the sea, the air, and let heaven itself be still. Then let it, meaning our soul, feel how into that silent heaven the great soul floweth in. Isn't that beautiful? Mm-hmm. Now look at the footnote over here. This actually is in Augustine word for word in the Confessions, and he brings over here that Plotinus read in Latin translation with the schoolmaster who made Augustine frum. He says it in different words. But
the Rebbe.
You're right. He was Augustine's Rebbe. Yeah, but that's these exact words. But it's beautiful. Then let it feel. You come to calm be the body for it in that hour. That's what's supposed to happen by Shmoneh Esrei. I mean, that's in Yiddishkeit we say you mizbeinin on a Kodesh Baruch Hu. You feel God's light in everything, and that brings to the stillness of the soul. How do you think? Why do you think Shmoneh Esrei is supposed to be quiet? Because you're not allowed to talk. Think about it for a second. Most people think, why can't you tell Shmoneh? You're not allowed to talk by Shmoneh Esrei. Nish does the var. Not that you're not allowed to talk by Shmoneh Esrei, right? The first line we say is Hashem Svasei Tiftach. What does that tell you? Not that you're not allowed to talk. What's supposed to happen?
He's talking for you.
Why? Why do you have to ask God to open up your mouth?
You can't talk.
Because you can't talk. You come to such a calm. You surrender yourself to that light of God, the great soul that's within everything. You feel, and by the way, that's why Psuke de Zimra. You ever wonder why Psuke de Zimra is the Akdama for davening? Never bother you? Every day, before you daven, every day of your life, you say, the sun and the Shemesh, Ve'erech, Ahar M'chol Gvois, mountains and hills, Remes V'tzipo Kanav, creepy crawly creatures and birds. Every day of your life, you speak about insects. First thing in the morning. Remes v'tziporkan, insects and birds. Why do you care about insects and birds? Well, why are you thinking about the sun and the National Geographic? Well, why are you thinking about all these things? What's the answer? To meditate on the great soul, on the light of God that's in everything, and come to the calm, the stillness, that will then allow you to step into God by Shmoneh Esrei. Turn the page.
Moshe at the sneh.
Exactly, Moshe at the sneh. That's right, Moshe at the sneh. And that's why Moshe falling on his face. That's the idea, but we just read last week's parsha. You ever wonder why all the psukim speak about how terrified the Jews were of Matan Torah? Vayanu v'yam demerochek, they were trembling, v'yechrad am, thunder and everything. It means that there was the complete overtaking of the world, that the world dissolved into God. And Shmoneh Esrei is supposed to be a little taste of that every time. Look how beautiful, next paragraph. As the sun's rays, now the imagery here is absolutely beautiful. As I told you, that's the second reason why we're doing this. As the sun's rays illumine a lowering cloud and make it gleam all gold, so soul entering the body of the heaven has given it life, has given it immortality and waked what lay supine, waked what lay sleeping. Moved now in endless motion by the soul directing it, it has become a living and a blessed thing. Earth, heaven, has become living and blessed by the soul of God that's within it, like a cloud that's been illuminated by the sun. Soul, once domiciled within, meaning it takes residence within, it takes worth where before was mere earth and water. The earth was just earth and water, but now that soul is within it, it takes worth.
Now
the blank,
it's turning.
Huh?
Now it's turning.
Now it's turning. Now it's alive. Now it's glowing. Slept. Zalebedik avelt. Chayay lomim.
No, what I'm saying is, unless I'm mistaken, this is where it's turning into paganism.
Well, because he's saying earth and water are separate.
That earth and water have life, that there's something more to them than now just earth and water.
So that wouldn't necessarily be paganism, that could just be a misnagid.
Okay.
Right? you're right, according to Chassidus, that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that the world is not something other than God is a chiddush of Chassidus, which I don't want to get into now, but that's not necessarily paganism yet. Look, so he says, by power of soul, the manifold and diverse heavenly system is one whole, the unity within reality. Anyone that ever read Emerson or Coleridge knows this.
Spinoza.
Well,
Spinoza believes that the entire universe is God.
Let's not get too off topic. It's a whole different thing. But Spinoza wouldn't necessarily say that there's something greater. Let's leave Spinoza for a second, okay? By power of soul, the manifold and diverse heavenly system is one whole. Through soul, this universe is a god. Now, here is also not paganism. He doesn't mean a god. He means to say a force. He means to say, like the Greeks called a god. The Greeks didn't, you know, he meant like a force, an object of power. And whosoever we ourselves may be, it is all in virtue of soul. Our own soul is of the same nature with this by which the gods are divine, meaning that we also have, the gods here, he means reality, we also have that divinity, that light of God within us, so that to consider purified, freed from all that is adventitious, meaning added to it, is to see how precious the essence of the soul is. Now the bottom he quotes from Plato's Republic, which is what Plato spoke about, the great philosopher king who come to an appreciation of the truth of this theory of ideas. Right? They shun everything that's adventitious. Far more honorable than anything bodily. Again, here you already see the strain of asceticism. Coming to the place of soul, which is deeper than body. Now listen to this. You honor the soul, capital S, you honor the soul elsewhere, honor then yourself. What does that mean? If you honor God, honor yourself, who's the light of God is within you. Now here we go. Here we start getting a little... here we get to paganism. Soul once seen to be thus precious, thus divine, you may hold the faith that by it you are already nearing God. So in Neoplatonism, soul is not God. Soul is an emanation that vivifies all of reality, which is an emanation from God, which is closer to God than this world, but is not yet God.
But he is a capital letter here.
I know, because they're all emanations from God, so they're all godly, but they're all pagan. That's what it means, paganism. There are different levels. There are different levels of... there's a hierarchy in the divine. So he would say that, and that's what Neoplatonism is about. It's reaching up to different levels of these gods until eventually the ultimate God. Now, in Hasidus, what would we call these two levels?
Worlds.
Well, worlds are the shell, are the clothes. Right, that the Tzilas Bria, these worlds are the, is what he was referring to, earth, etc. That's what's being vivified, being vitalized. They're the clouds that have the ray of the sun in them. But what would we call soul with a capital S, and what would we call God? Or, I mean, if any of you daven Sechsvard, you say it every single day in davening.
Tzilas?
Tzilas doesn't mean God. This soul with capital S, we believe, is the Eivishter. Anyone ever say the words, L'shem Yichud Kutcher Berchu V'Shchintei? Ever say that? Anyone daven Sechsvard? You don't daven Sechsvard? You ever heard of that?
Sure.
What does it mean, Yichud Kutcher Berchu V'Shchintei? What are you unifying? How many gods are there? As far as I remember, Judaism believes in monotheism. So what do you unify in Kutcher Berchu and his Shechina? What does that mean?
The Shechina is down here. Where is Shechina? And the Kutcher Berchu is...
But what is Shechina?
Us.
Not God?
It's the God's presence right down here. Right. Yeah.
But it's not God.
It's not. it's again...
That's paganism. Right? That's paganism. To say that there's a Shechina...
it's connected. So
I know, right? So you know, in theology, semantics matter a lot.
Right,
so it's not enough just to say it's connected and have some kind of foggy. We have to. What does that mean? Shechina is godliness. It's God's light that vivifies the world. The Shechina is what Shechenes Mestabeshes B'Tachtonim. It's the light of God that's permeating reality. It's soul with capital S. But when you say it's connected with God, let me ask you: your hand. Is your hand you?
Part of me.
Yeah.
It's part of you, right? It's not you only, but it's part of you.
Is the light that we're using now the light?
No, I'm not talking about the physical. I'm talking about God's light, not talking about physical light.
The same thing. The hand, meaning is light, that's a bulb, but is the light that's coming from there part of the bulb, or is it not part of the bulb?
Part of the bulb.
The reason that I'm...
So it's the same with God.
The problem with using that mushel, remind me your name again?
Okay, Lenny.
Lenny, the problem with using that mushel is that the light that leaves the bulb is taka no longer connected to the bulb. That's why I brought the mushel of the hand. Mm-hmm. That mushel is used sometimes in other reasons, but over here I want to dafk use the mushel of the hand because that light, once it leaves the bulb, is like that mushel is what Plotinus is talking about. What you just said is that's why it's paganism. It's exactly the point I want to say now. It's paganism when you look at God and soul as being light bulb and light coming from light bulb.
Cause and effect.
Cause and effect, source and luminary and light. That's paganism. In other words, if anyone ever says to you, and I love, this is the way I like to check with like people know what they're talking about. When you say, what is the Shekhinah? If they say to you, it's an energy that God sent to the world, that's good old-fashioned paganism. Because that means you've essentially said that God sent an energy that's not connected to him. Einoin milvadai, even at the most basic level of nigla, means that there's no force in the world other than God. God didn't delegate authority, not to angels, not to spheres, not to anything. All there is the Eibishter. When a leaf is moving in a tree, God is moving it. So the Shekhinah, yes, it's a contracted ray of God's light. Yes. It permeates all of reality. Yes. It corresponds to soul with capital S. Yes. But it's more connected to God than your hand is with you.
Yeah. In Shekhinah, but at the same time, everything exists within God, right? That's what Echad Mit is.
Right.
So then, I mean, again, so you're playing, it's a semantics game, but it's Shekhinah, but ultimately everything is existing within Hashem, right? In God, right?
Yes, the question is, what does it mean, Yichud Kutcher Bruchu V'Shchinte? What do you need to unite them? So I'll just say very, again, I don't want to get too much off topic, but since we're talking about it, if you imagine all the worlds as, let's say your fingernail, or your finger is connected to you. So your finger is you, but it's not all of you. So if you look at, let's say, all the worlds as they're descending from God as a contracted ray of His light, mm-hmm. Purpose of creation is where does God essence want to be? Imagine you putting all of who you are in your fingernail. That's the purpose
that's
of creation.
Kabbalah, that's Kabbalah Hasidus right there.
Correct.
I mean, Kabbalah is saying it's coming down, and Hasidus is saying it's here.
Okay, I anything that you could summarize in a sentence is probably not going to be the full picture. One of my pet peeves, I'm telling you, one of my pet peeves as a teacher is when I give a shiur for an hour and I break my neck to explain it, you know, and I schwitz and I prepare, I'm going to say it. And then after the class, somebody comes up and he's like, Sir Rabbit, what you essentially want to say is, and they give me like a one-liner. You know what I'm saying? If that's what I wanted to say, I would have said it. You know what I mean?
To get to that point where it's clear.
So right. Okay, I hear you. You're right. But it's a little, it's more complex than that. But yeah, the idea is that Chassidus comes to say, Kabbalah says that the worlds are just emanations from God's light. Chassidus comes in and says, yes, but those emanations are connected to His essence, and the purpose of creation is to bring His essence in a revealed way in this world. Yes. But for relevant to what we're learning here, the reason I want to just show you is how, why Kabbalah is not like this, is that in Plotinus and Neoplatonism, soul, capital S soul, how does he say? You're nearing God. You're nearing God. In Kabbalah and Chassid, that would be paganism. By us, when you meditate on the light of God that's in the world, it's not that you're nearing God. That is God. When I shake your hand, I'm touching you. I'm not near to you. I'm touching you. In the mountains and the hills and the sun and the valleys and the creepy crawly creatures and the insects and your children's faces is not just an emanation from God like the sun... light from the bulb, you're touching God. Mm-hmm. It's only God's hand. If you want to hug God's entire body, what do you need to do? If you want to hug God's entire essence, you need to learn a black Gemara or do a mitzvah. That's why Chassidus and Kabbalah never... don't forget, the world is only God's finger. It's only the Shekhinah. God's essence is in a black Gemara, is in a pasuk in Chumash, is in a mitzvah. Right? But the point I'm just saying is that this is the idea that the soul, we believe you meditate on soul, and in our religion, soul is God's hand, so to speak. Yeah.
Doesn't Chassidus contemplate this, or I think Kabbalah, doesn't Kabbalah contemplate this idea of Tzimtzum with different, you know, vessels that he contracts himself into this and this, and you have Ein Sof, but then I don't understand the difference.
You don't understand the difference?
I don't understand the difference. I don't know why one is pagan. You're saying... I understand to be what you're saying.
Your finger Is it near to you, or is it you?
It's me.
Right. That's Kabbalah. Tzimtzum is to get from you to the finger. To get from Ein Sof, all the Tzimtzumim, to get to this chair that you're sitting
but
on.
But those vessels are not Ein Sof, right? Isn't that the whole point? He contracted himself. It's not his essence.
So your
My
your
finger
hand
is me.
Not your essence.
It's me.
But it's not your essence.
Okay.
Right? It's not your essence. I always give the mushal when somebody says to me, if Chassidus says that everything in the world is godliness, so eat, drink, and be merry. How does which the Vilna Gaon was afraid about that, right? Why should I learn Torah? Why should I do mitzvahs? So I give the following mashal. I'm a romantic by nature, so that's why. Imagine your beloved is in jail. And is locked away in jail for 50 years. Your wife is locked away in jail for 50 years. But they let her put a few hairs outside the window of the cell that you could hold on to. What's the problem? Or she could stick her finger out of the cell. Will that make you happy? It's her finger. That's the answer. The world, the contractions, the vessel, all these things are contracted levels of him. Torah mitzvah is God's essence. But the point is that that's what davening is. You begin by soul and you come to God. But in Planus, it's two different things. Let's read further.
How do you explain the Rambam's and Rambam's idea of an agent intellect?
So, I know we're not on one foot, but we can do Kol HaTerakula tonight.
Okay.
But in a few lines, I'm going to get to something similar to it, and I'll. You're talking about news. You're talking about I'll mention it.
So could you just go back again?
Bringing God's essence into the fingernail, into this world. Kutchabrichu into Shechina. Right now, the Shechina is in Kutchabrichu because we're within Ein Sof. Right, the drop is in the ocean. Mashiach, the purpose of Torah Mitzvah is to bring the entire ocean into the drop. That's Yichud Kudshevich of Shchintay. Let's read further. Soul once seemed to be thus precious, thus divine, you may hold the faith that by it you are already near in God. In the strength of this power, raise yourself to Him. In other words, in our Avodas Hashem, that means when you meditate that the beautiful world that you see is God's light, what do you then want? You don't want to just hold His finger. You want to go to God. You don't want to remain with God's finger. You see the beauty of the world. You go to a beautiful vacation and you see the beauty of the world. Now what should happen if you meditate properly is, oh my God, look how beautiful the world is. Look how beautiful Niagara Falls. Look how beautiful the forest. Look how beautiful the sunset. That's all His finger. That's all just a ray of God's light. I want to hug the King Himself. You have to dive into Blad Gemara or into Shemone Esrei. In the strength of this power, raise yourself to Him. At no great distance you must attain. There is not much between. Once you come to soul, you're very close to God. But over this soul divine, there is a diviner still its prior and its source. For though so great a thing, soul is but an image and an utterance of divine mind. Now here he's still not by God. There's another level called divine mind, which corresponds to the Rambam and the Ralbag. That right over here. So that's why it's mamish paganism. So there's soul, which is the soul of the world. Then there's divine mind. And only then will we get to God. In Kabbalah, this corresponds exactly to Malchus. Shechina is soul. Chochma d'Atzilus, Chabad, anyone that knows the higher level spheres, is the divine mind. Right? Which again, is if let's say until now we were talking about the finger. Mm-hmm. What are the 10 spheres? Your mind. Is your mind your essence? Also not. But it's a lot more than your finger. That's the 10 spheres, right? That's divine mind. And that's what the Rambam and the Ralbag were talking about. And the soul is but an image, but you see how it's but an image of an utterance of divine mind. The stream of life sent forth by it, meaning by divine mind, sends forth soul to the production of further being. The forthgoing heat of a fire in which also heat essentially inheres. Divine mind is like the fire, and the heat that comes from the beautiful mushal, the heat that comes from the fire is the soul that gives life to the world. Anyone that knows Kabbalah, the concept of Abba Yasa Brata, which means Malchus comes from Chachma Datzilus. God's mind speaks the Shechina that becomes the life of this world. Let's skip the brackets. But again, but you see how there are all these emanations, they're one level deep. So paganism is when you see them as separated. Or if a person learns Kabbalah improperly, which is how some Kabbalah centers teach it, as being separated forces, that's good old paganism. If you don't always bring it back to the Echad, If you don't always unite them all back to the source. Let's skip the brackets.
And I assume he doesn't.
He does not. That's why it's paganism.
And he's the father. He's the teacher of Augustine.
Right? So Augustine also obviously made it more into monotheism. Mm. But the whole concept, what you see here, is that there's ascending from one emanation to another. And each emanation is a distinct level. It's a distinct entity.
They never tie it back together.
Again, they have a connection, but they're emanations. The emesis, I don't want to say it, but the emesis that there are some people that learn Kabbalah like this. There are some people that learn Kabbalah like this, but it is that would be of it as Zohar Mamish. People that don't learn Kabbalah properly, that look at the ray of light as being something that God sent and it's no longer connected to God. It's Mamish of it as Zohar. That's what the Vilna Gaon was afraid of. That's what people were afraid of, teaching Kabbalah to people that won't understand properly. Ten Sefiros D'Atzilus, it's something else. If you read Kabbalah, you know that the Zohar reads like a Daniel Steele novel, Lahavdil, right? With all these, this erratic imagery, this one getting, you know, unifications with this, it's mamish, it's very, all these different partsufim and everything. If you don't always connect it to the echad, you don't always meditate how it's all one, which, and again, it's very easy to meditate, like within ourselves, your finger's one with you, your mind is one with you, but none of them is your essence, and they're united with you, but you always have to be bringing it back to the echad. Otherwise, you're chas shom, what the Zohar calls, koitzetz benetiyos. Who remembers the Gemara in Chagiga Daf Yud Gimel? What was the biggest problem? What did Rabbi Akiva, you all know the story of the four that entered the paradise. What did Rabbi Akiva warn them before they entered the paradise? Who remembers? You remember what Rabbi Akiva warned them? You know the story in the Gemara, right? Everyone remembers the story? Kshetagiyu lamakam avne shayish tar al toimru mayim mayim. When you come to the place of pure marble, do not say water, water, mayim, mayim, that there are two types of water, upper waters and lower waters. So all the Arizal already explained that Gemara and Chagiga. What was he saying, Rabbi Akiva? When you, it's all one piece of shayish, it's all one piece of marble. Al tamer mayim, mayim. Don't say that there's upper waters and lower waters and there are two types of water. Which Chassidus goes to town with and says, you daven and then you go to work. And you think, oh, until now I was connecting to Hashem, now I go to my office. That's mayim mayim. And the Baal Shem Tov said, you were learning about Gemara, now you go eat dinner, al toimer mayim mayim, upper and lower waters. It's one avnishay, it's one piece of marble, it's one abishter, echad, havai echad. What do you want to ask?
Why is it automatically become a vodazar? I mean, the light...
is separated from God?
I'm not saying that. I don't believe that the lower light is God. Hashem created this light and gave it to me, and I'm not confused.
What is that light doing?
Hashem gave it to me to enjoy the world, to use the world.
But that light is giving you vitality right now. Right? That light is giving you vitality right now. Not God.
Why is it it's giving me vitality?
I know, you tell me.
God's giving me vitality. He created things that operate separate from Him, but that doesn't...
If they operate separate from Him,
but then I'm not. I don't
so you know, it's
them.
it's not it's shituf. It's not a. Let's call it shituf. Mm-hmm. It's not a. It's shituf. You know what shituf is? What
doesn't shituf still mean that I'm?
He expresses it so clearly.
Exactly, Rambam and Avodah first parak. Yeah, that's mamash what the Rambam was talking about. When the Rambam speaks about how did paganism begin, I don't want to get into it too much. But if you bring it up, how did paganism begin? You remember the Rambam parak off of Avodah Zarah? What does he say?
It starts off just.
That there's a star. This star is in charge of cucumbers. This star is in charge of tomatoes, which is true.
And then I start to worship.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who decides if I get a raise, my boss or God? So that's where shituf. Shituf is, okay, you're right, it's not a way to Zohar would be considered shituf, that I believe there's God, but that he delegated authority to his little elves and little helpers. That's shituf. That's believing that there are other authorities other than God. Let's read further. Here is contained, we're skipping to the brackets to the next page. The other side of the page where the asterisk is. Because we don't have to get too much. Here is contained all that is immortal. Nothing here but his divine mind. All is God. This is the place of every soul in rest unbroken. For how can that seek change? And once you come to that stage, every soul rests there, unbroken. For how can that, meaning God, seek change in which all is well? What need that reach to which holds all within itself? How beautiful. Its knowing is not by search, but by possession. God doesn't need to search to know. He possesses. Its blessedness inherent, not acquired. This is pure being, in eternal actuality. This is already a forerunner of Heidegger. We're going to speak later on, Soloveitchik brings from Heidegger, Heidegger's whole philosophy is a philosophy about being, very much based on Plato and Aristotle. This is pure being in eternal actuality. Nowhere is there any future, for every then is a now. Any of you ever read The Power of Now? Eckhart Tolle?
Yeah.
You read it? It's a great book. If you look at Tanya chapter 33, everything in that book is in Tanya chapter 33. It's just, that's just an elaboration of Tanya chapter 33. All simcha, shavas, and nefesh, calm, all comes from that power of now, in Tanya Parak 33, of that, what he's saying over here. When you reach that state of God, you are the whole unity of all of reality, your ultimate being, eternal actuality. Nowhere is there any future. Every then is a now. Nor is there any past, for nothing there has ever ceased to be. Everything has taken its stand forever, and everything is divine mind and authentic existence. You should meditate on these things by davening. That's what you're supposed to feel by davening.
It could be a Jewish book.
I'm telling you, it's beautiful. If you meditate on this, look at Tanya, this is your homework. Look at Tanya chapter 33, and you'll see Mamash what he's saying over here. That's what davening is supposed to be. Bringing itself close to divine, and again, what's he saying? What was the point? Remember how we began this chapter? What's he saying, all of these meditations? What was he saying? You remember? How did he begin? The soul forgot where it came from. It wandered far away from the Father. So we have to reverse that,
so
right?
Recipe for tshuva, right?
Recipe for prayer. You're not even tshuva every time you pray, right? To raise yourself back up to God. Bringing itself close to divine mind, becoming one with it, soul seeks still further. Now again, here he's talking about that soul and divine mind are different levels. But we would say, you come to the Shechina, you meditate, that comes from the 10 spheres of Atzilus called divine mind. But then what do you want to bring the Shechina and the 10 spheres of Atzilus, what do you want to unite that with? With Ein Sof, with God. What being now has engendered this God? What is the one preceding this multiple? What is the one, the absolute one from which divine mind and soul emanate from? Before duality, there must stand the unity. Now, you don't have on your page, I didn't make another copy, but I'm just going to read to you these next three lines, okay? You ready? You don't have it, I didn't copy it, but just listen. But what did he just say? So you're coming to the one that precedes everything? Now listen to this. In venturing an answer, we first invoke God himself. Not by uttered word, but by way of prayer. Not by uttered word, but by way of prayer, meaning prayer is not, in its essence, the uttered word. The uttered word is the chitzonius of prayer, right? Again, in venturing an answer, we first invoke God himself, not by uttered word, but by way of prayer, leaning the soul towards him, God, by aspiration, alone towards the alone.
Okay.
Alone, capital A, with alone, lowercase a, to the alone with capital A. Alone towards the alone. Isn't that beautiful? That's what the Rav is referring to, I think. Alone towards the alone.
This is what the Rav was studying in Berlin?
I'm sure. This also, I know, when he was studying philosophy, he definitely said, this is Plotinus' is philosophy, you know, to understand Plato, you need, Plato's a later Plotinus as well. The Rav quotes Neoplatonism all the time in Halachic Man.
Yeah. And if you didn't divide these into different levels, disconnected levels, if soul with a capital S is God,
is
divine mind,
yeah,
is a
sphere.
That would be okay then.
Totally, that's why I learned it with you.
Right?
The reason I learned it with you...
is connected into different levels of paganism?
Yeah. And that's why I learned it with you, because we're understanding, again, I'm not going to argue with Yaakov here, because I know him for many years already, I know he's dying to argue with me weiter, but we believe that he took it from Plato, got it from Kabbalah, or the academics say Kabbalah got it from... Whatever it is, it's ideas that we believe in. As long as you say, my point is that you connect them together. But this beautiful idea... is that prayer is, and this is what Chassidus is a million times in all of Mamarm, it's just not as beautifully stated in English like over here, but all the Mamarm is saying to, that Psukah de Zimra is meditating on soul. Soul meaning Mamali Kolam, and the light of God that fills the world, the Shekhinah, the finger of God. Then you come to Kriyashma, and you unite the Aleph, the Ches, and the Dal, the Ches, the different spheres, and the Dal, unite the ten spheres, the divine mind with God. You rise up to the ten spheres, the source of the worlds. And then by Shemoneh Esrei, you stand in the Ein Sof, and you calmly rest within God's essence. That's what prayer is. Alone, leaning towards the alone. Alone with a lowercase a, leaning towards the alone with a capital A.
I understand why God is alone. Why am I alone?
Because the whole point is you're raising yourself up out of the reality of the community, and you come to that way that you want to reach the alone. You want to just go up to God.
Why can't I reach God as a community, as a union? Why do I have to be alone?
That's the dialectic that this whole book is going to be about. In other words, what he's going to say is, and he's saying, I'm in a community, and yet I feel lonely. And he's going to say that the man of faith needs to feel lonely because, let's read the sentence again, what we began today, in the Rav. I also feel invigorated, you see? I also feel invigorated by this loneliness, because this very experience of loneliness presses everything in me into the service of God. It forces me to connect to God in a deeper way. In my desolate, howling solitude, I experience a growing awareness that, to paraphrase Plotinus's apothegm about prayer, alone leading towards alone, I think that's what the Rav means, this service to which I, a lonely and solitary individual, am committed, which service?
Prayer.
This service of ascending, going out of the world and going towards God, is wanted and gratefully accepted by God in His transcendental loneliness and numinous solitude. There has to be a way of going into yourself, and through that going up to God, and yet be in a minyan. That's why I keep saying, you're Shemoneh Esrei, it's just you and God. No one else there. I'll tell you an anecdote, which I've said before, maybe some of you heard it from me, but when I really chapped what tefillah is, you know, sometimes you could read Svarim and everything, and then all of a sudden you have that, you know, aha moment.
The gestalt,
the aha moment, what does Stephen Covey call it? The paradigm shift. I was in Zichron Moshe. You know what Zichron Moshe is in Yerushalayim?
It's a minion factory.
Well, minion factory is a nice way of talking about it. The Zichron Moshe is a whole, you know, if you ever want to get people, like, to not be impressed by the aesthetics of Judaism, take him to Zichron Moshe. Anyway, so I was in Zichron Moshe, and I had just went shopping in Girsa, which is a great Sfarim store right across the street, and I had like two, you know, kedarki, that I don't just get one book, I had two bags of books, and I went into Zichron Moshe. This is, I'm talking like 18 years ago, my first year in Eretz Yisrael, and I put the bags of books down next to me. Now, Yerushalayim is a very holy place, but, you know, even like Shlomo Kabach said, they're the holy thieves in all places. So I kept my hand on the bags while I was davening Shemoneh Esrei. I kept my hand on the bags. When I finished, this guy comes over to me. It's Yerushalmi Yid. It's a Yid with a white beard. I never saw him before. I never saw him after. And he says to me, That's not called davening. Holding on to a bag. He says, when you daven, it's only you and the Eibishter. That's it. Not even holding on to a bag of books. It's just you and the Eibishter. You can't. That's not called davening. And that's like Rav Soloveitchik says. That's the philosophical reason for a mechitza. You can't sit next to your wife and really daven. You have to feel this certain loneliness. There's a certain litnatek ma mitziyut, to go out of the world. To go out of the world. To go up to God. That's what prayer is. And that's an experience of loneliness which could be used to have a deeper relationship with God. So we'll continue with Hashem next week.
Is there like distraction here? Is that
huh?
So the loneliness is not being distracted by other things?
Well, the not being distracted is something that a person has to deal with by davening. Mm-hmm. But the loneliness he's talking about is something a lot more automatic. A lot more descriptive of a person's experience than just having to deal with distractions. What he's talking about, the Rav, and we've been learning over the past weeks, is this is an essential loneliness that he feels, that people that we've spoken about the past 2 weeks, that the past two times, that there's a loneliness that we're all feeling, that people feel in today's day and age, which is causing so many issues and problems. But the Rav is going to say to harness that loneliness and that alienation that we feel, and that feeling of not feeling comfortable in our own skin, so to speak, because of our faith, and to use that in a way to get closer to Hashem. That's what he's going to be speaking about in this book.
Okay, what are angels?
What do you mean, what are?
How do
what are angels as far as God is concerned? Are they separate or are they God?
They're completely separate. They're spiritual beings, but they're completely separate from God.
So then,
I mean, separate like trees.
So then that goes back to the paganism issue, that we have this separate, even in our
That's why it's the fifth principle of faith of Maimonides, of the 13 principles, is that not to make an angel a mamutza, an intermediary.
Yeah, but it does exist as a something between, not between, not separating us, but at a higher level, but not God, but not as low as us. Or totally a separate being, maybe lower than us, because they don't have any choice, they don't want Torah or less. But it is something separate emanating from God, which is what you
that's
said.
The word is separate. What is separate?
So they're not. It depends what you mean by separate.
Well,
okay. It depends what you mean by separate. But
don't
not Machniz Rachamim is bachlal a big issue. Rav Soloveitchik and Alef Man brings that. That's bachlal. Let's talk about this next week, because okay. I don't want to shmai dried. If it's we're talking about fundamentals of faith.
Okay.
I'll give it 10-15 minutes at the beginning of next week.
In the last sentence of your reading, should there be a comma after "am committed"?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you don't have to, because is where it goes from the subject to the predicate. In other words,
not to me. It doesn't. I mean, the way we read it, I understand it either way. But I would think from a totally grammatical standpoint.
If you take out the words "alone," the entire individual,
right?
You would say this service to which I am committed.
Right.
Is wanted. So you don't have to. You don't have to because okay. is the not appropriate.
Well, but there is that phrase there. It's a minor point. It's not worth it. Yeah. Thank you.
Shabbos morning at Belzer, facing Mikdash.
Uh-huh.